This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Ranchford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning as many of us are celebrating the back-to-back wins of UConn basketball, the men's team winning the national championship. This is my first show after coming back from spring training. I apologize for some of the technical difficulties we had last week. But we are back live today and for the foreseeable future. And today my guest is going to be Dr. James O'Day. He's been on our program before. He's a senior vice president for the Behavioral Health Network for Hartford Healthcare. He's a clinical psychologist, and he's going to talk to us about loneliness. We've heard the Surgeon General talk about the epidemic of loneliness that is affecting so many Americans. So let's talk about that and some of the things we could do about addressing loneliness and how it impacts our healthcare system. So he'll be on in the second half of the program. In the second section of the program, I'm going to catch up and address many of your emails that have come through with questions and suggestions. So we're going to talk about some of the emails that I have received recently. We're also going to talk a little bit about a different concept. You know, when we talk about concussion, and I had to give a lecture on this yesterday to our orthopedic residents at the University of Connecticut, we don't want to mistake it for something else. And one of those things that has really become really more obvious and more profound to us as practitioners is dizziness that comes from the neck, comes from the cervical spine. So we're going to be talking a little bit more about that in the next section of our program. Today's date in medicine, April 13, 1872, Dr. George Huntington, at the age of 22, published a concise description of a hereditary chorea. Now you have to understand, chorea is a hyperkinetic movement. It's an asymmetric movement that is involuntary that you see in patients. But what was different about this was that in Huntington's chorea, or Huntington's disease as we call it now, because we know it's more than just the movement disorder, it is an incurable degenerative disease that affects the brain, and its earliest symptoms are typically mental and psychiatric, and followed by a lack of coordination or unsteady gait. Now, historically, the issue here was that many of the patients were committed to hospitals for the mentally ill and felt to have their mental condition being the prominent factor. So very few people were recognized that this was a neurodegenerative disease and still not curable, but we've made a lot of progress over the course of the past 30 to 50 years. I had the pleasure of working with one of the pioneers in this disease, Dr. Ann Young and her husband, Jack Penny, at the University of Michigan. And what was interesting about their work was they went to a place called Lake Maracaibo in Venezuela. Now, this is a hereditary disease, and it's an autosomal dominant disease. So that means if one parent has it, it will pass on. So with that, they did a lot of studies because it was so much interfamilial offspring and relatives that had it in this area of Venezuela. They did some of the original genetic studies. And what we've found is that we've been able to at least isolate the gene and the abnormalities. So now, as we are making progress with gene alteration and the CRISPR technologies, it's hopeful that we can make some changes and anticipate this disease. I can tell you, as someone who has treated families with this, it is a devastating illness. It really just tears people apart, and they require so much care. One of the most famous people who had it was a singer by the name of Woody Guthrie. We remember his son, probably people our age, is Arlo Guthrie. But Woody Guthrie was diagnosed with this problem way back many years ago. So we see this, and we remember Dr. Huntington today. One of the things I did want to touch on also is, again, the COVID vaccine. The CDC does recommend getting an updated COVID vaccination for folks over the age of 65 and those who are vulnerable to the illness every 4 months. And what we have also seen is that there is no downside. It's not like, well, you can get too much of the COVID vaccine. But by the same token, in order to be careful about it, in fact, I went while I was down at spring training, went and got the vaccine. My wife and I got it so that we have that extra bit of protection. Although we're hearing about the symptoms being mild, you just don't want to have it and have it get in the way of your enjoyment, especially during the summer. As always, I think in the fall, and we'll be starting to see it rolling out with a new variation to give us the most protection when we come up into the fall and when the season becomes a lot greater for that. So, again, please keep that in mind if you are among those folks. Also, one of the things we've been hearing a lot about is Wegovy and Ozempic. These are the so-called GLP-1 drugs used for weight loss. And there was some speculation that they may add to a risk of suicide or self-harm in people using these medications. But a study that was just released that was done in a large scale in Europe did not find any relation to depression and suicide in people using these medications. And as we can tell from the many millions and millions of people using these medications, don't forget, these were used for diabetes before, that the risk and side effect from these medications is relatively low. So again, important to keep in mind, but also important to keep in mind using the medication like this for weight loss only if it's necessary and under a doctor's recommendation and a doctor's guidance. With that, we're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back to chat a little bit about some of the topics that have been brought up by our listeners, as well as talking about a concept and something we're starting to notice called cervicogenic dizziness. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And as always, I'm available at our email at info@alessimd.com. And happy to take questions either live on the air or during the week. As I mentioned before, our guest at 11:30 will be Dr. James O'Day. Jim O'Day, a good friend and friend of the program, will be on to talk a little bit about this epidemic of loneliness that has really begun to take hold on our country. As far as listener email, I got an interesting one from Bonnie I wanted to talk about. She requested that we get a guest on to talk about restless legs syndrome. And I'm working on that, Bonnie, and we will have someone on soon to talk about it. And for those unfamiliar with restless leg syndrome, it's this strong urge to move your legs. Typically, it bother someone at night where they have to get up and walk around and get some relief with movement. I mean, there are 3 million cases a year diagnosed in the United States, and often it's misdiagnosed for something different that's affecting the lower extremities. It's classified as a movement disorder, so we're going to be talking with several movement disorder specialists and getting someone on with a special interest in restless legs syndrome. There are medications that are used for it, so we want to talk a little bit about that and things people can do. So, Bonnie, thanks for bringing that up, and I am on it. Peter sent me an interesting email about blocking a protein to stop the destruction of protrusions on nerve cells in the brain. So basically, the ability to block this particular protein may be a key to Alzheimer's disease. And, you know, we get so many comments here regarding Alzheimer's disease that it's important that we keep up with that. And there is so much going on in that field. So it was interesting because it made me aware of this effect and this strategy of blocking this protein in order to avoid destruction of the nerves. And as things come up, I'll be sure to report back to everyone. There was another one by one of our listeners who got in touch with me regarding the norovirus contagion. You know, we see this a lot on cruise ships or wherever people are in close contact with food for an extended period of time. And that's why, you know, we've come to see if you're on a cruise or on a ship, there's always these sinks lined up for you to wash your hands before getting on, before going into the dining room. It's so important to do. When handling food and being around food. The norovirus is one of the viruses that causes GI symptoms. So a lot of vomiting and diarrhea are the biggest problems with that. One of the things I did want to talk about was something I mentioned, which is cervicogenic dizziness. Now, cervicogenic dizziness presents with a symptoms of kind of a heavy or full-headedness, a rarely true vertigo. So a lot of times we'll see patients who come in and just say, I feel foggy or my head feels heavy. So it's not true dizziness where you feel like you're spinning around or someone or the room is spinning around. So the patients present with complaints of neck pain, stiffness of their neck, visual changes, nausea, vomiting, headaches, ringing in the ears. These are very similar symptoms that you're going to see from a concussion. So often people who are involved in a motor vehicle accident, a rear-ended motor vehicle accident, start to present with these complaints and are under the impression that they have a brain injury. This is not a brain injury, it's a neck injury. And when you're examined for the problem, the real issue is going to someone who has experience, like a neurologist, to examine your neck muscles for tenderness, look at cervical movements, look for any imbalance that you're having with your gait. So again, very important from that standpoint to really look at someone's gait and see if they are off balance. The most common form of cervicogenic dizziness is what we call proprioceptive cervicogenic dizziness. To explain proprioception, to best explain it, is we have sensory receptors in our limbs and in our extremities that tell us if there's movement going on. So they're sensors that bring impulses to the brain to know things are going up or down. So when I'm examining a patient, I will often have them close their eyes and move their great toe either up or down and ask them to tell me which way it's moving. Same thing, do the same thing in a finger. So again, you're testing proprioception. The interesting part of that is we also have these same sensors in our neck. So they tell us which way our head might be moving. And again, that's so important to communicate that with the brain so you know you move. When there is dysfunction, when there's a miscommunication, you will get the feeling of dizziness. So again, those proprioceptive fibers become important, and they are again often injured with a neck injury. So they're always telling us about this continued movement of our head, neck, our eyes, and our body. So what we'll also see is a lot of muscle spasm, cervical trauma. People, here's one where we start to see it. As we get older and we develop degenerative changes in the cervical spine, again, we're going to see a problem with respect to that, because we're not able to move our neck fully, and it really means that we need to reset these sensory pathways. So how do you treat it? Well, you treat it the same way you treat other neck pain, right? We use anti-inflammatory medications, physical therapy, and something we call vestibular therapy. From the standpoint of physical therapy, we really want the patients to get massage, heat, range of motion, exercises. You want to kind of refresh those pathways and try to get them working again in a most efficient manner. The other thing are vestibular therapy, which is that balance therapy or vision therapy where you're following objects with your eye. There are a series of very basic exercises that you can do to improve the vestibular apparatus. This is particularly important in baseball. Baseball is the most difficult sport to come back to after a head or neck injury. And the reason being, right, you have to pick up the spin of the ball, right? You have to coordinate what you're seeing with your eye, with your neck, and then implement a motor function to hit that baseball. So as much as we see this more in football and other things, it's not as hard to get back to those sports as it is to hitting a baseball. So that specific function of being able to hit a baseball becomes very, very difficult with cervicogenic dizziness or head trauma. So again, it's important to be seen by a physician who has experience in following patients with these conditions to know which is the most important part of your rehabilitation to getting back to where you are. With that, we're going to take a short break, and we're going to be back with my guest today, Dr. Jim O'Day. Dr. O'Day is Vice President for the Behavioral Health Network at Hartford Healthcare. He's going to be talking to us about loneliness and also going to be introducing us to something new at Hartford Healthcare, a new facility that has opened up in our area. Once again, if you have questions, you can get them over to me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And it's great to have as my guest, Dr. James O'Day. Dr. O'Day is a clinical psychologist. He is also Senior Vice President for Behavioral Health Network for Hartford Healthcare. He has been on our show before and a great resource for all of us. Jim, welcome back.
Tony, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
I wanted to get you on to really get right to it. The Surgeon General has advised us that we're now facing an epidemic of loneliness and isolation in this country. Can you explain that a little bit for our audience?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. Thank you. Yeah, well, the Surgeon General has responsibility to highlight what are the most significant public health issues that are affecting this country. And it is noteworthy that the Surgeon General has made a choice to put out an advisory on what is being really understood as an epidemic of people feeling disconnected from others, a sense of social isolation, and the health consequences, Tony, for people feeling lonely, isolated. It's not a small thing. It actually has very significant impacts, not just on a sense of well-being in your personal life. It also has very significant consequences associated with any other health condition, results in an increased risk of heart disease, increased risk of stroke. It's a very significant issue, and it's been growing, and it is now, I believe, and along with the Surgeon General and so many others, is a genuine public health crisis in this country.
Jim, let's talk about it, because loneliness is such a general term. I mean, is it self-imposed loneliness? Is it a function of a personality? What's driving loneliness? I mean, we're hearing about all the time people who, oh, I connected on Facebook and I've got all these friends on Instagram or whatever. Okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I guess I'm trying to figure out where the disconnect is here in terms of what is driving this loneliness.
Yeah, appreciate that. I would say a couple things. We can't escape the idea that it was just several years ago that we were dealing with a global pandemic. And during the pandemic, people basically purposely and for very good health-related reasons isolated themselves, put themselves in situations where they minimized contact with others because it could have resulted in harm. And so, you know, we find ourselves now 3.5-4 years after the pandemic, really as a society trying to readjust. So I don't think there's any doubt that the pandemic in some ways sort of was a catalyst to what had been a growing issue. But prior to that, you know, the emergence of social media has absolutely been contributory. And I look at this and I talk to people and they say, yeah, I've got, you know, 560 friends, quote unquote, on Facebook. And I think to myself, are they really friends? Like, what is the definition of friendship nowadays? If you think you have 516, quote unquote, friends, what's the nature of the relationship that you actually have with people that are close to you?
So let's back up a little bit. When we define it as an epidemic, what are we talking about in terms of numbers here?
Yeah. Well, it changes based on different demographic groups. And so the truth is, if you take a look at, you know, the more protected, if you will, or insulated communities, older adults actually don't experience this as dramatic as younger adults. But certainly we see an explosion in a sense of disconnectedness and social isolation in young adults between the ages of 18 and 35 years old. As many as 40% of these individuals are saying, I'm not feeling like I've got the right supports in my life. I don't know who to turn to. When I'm suffering, I don't feel like I've got people who care about me in a way that really is going to be helpful to me. Interesting for other groups, and I'll use, you know, older adults, social media is a gift. Yeah, I have a 92-year-old mother. She's able to connect with her grandkids and her children using Facebook in a way that she never would have been able to do, to travel around the country and see people. So I don't want to paint social media as a villain here, but I don't think we can ignore the reality is there are social engineers out there that are designing Facebook to get people to get really addicted, and I use that term very seriously, addicted to the use of scrolling, and being focused on their likes, as opposed to thinking about how do I have real deep, meaningful relationships so that when things hit a bad patch, I've got people I can count on.
It's interesting because you brought up the idea of insulated communities, and you know, most recently with the tragedy that's happened in Israel, I've learned a little bit more about people living in kibbutzes, right? This communal type of living.
Yes.
It almost sounds like growing up when you had a community, right? You were at church or you knew your neighbors. I mean, the old joke is, you know, when people knocked on your door, you couldn't wait to have them in and have them in for coffee and cake. Now somebody knocks on your door, you run and hide. So
yeah.
I'm wondering, so it sounds like those communities are less vulnerable to loneliness. Am I right in thinking that way?
It's completely correct. And actually, what's pretty clear is those people who are connected to, and faith communities, Tony, is a really good example. People who are connected to the people that they share faith with, they go to mosque, they go to temple, they go to church. These are shared experience where you are genuinely connected with another person and you are catching up with them about the ups and downs of life. Those people are absolutely protected from some of these risks, as opposed to people who are living a lot of isolation, spend a lot of time by themselves, and don't have those same kind of protections. And it isn't just faith. It can also be I'm part of a hiking club, or I play basketball on Tuesday and Thursday nights with the same group of guys or women. You know, there is something about you really have to be purposeful and intentional about building the supports in your life. If you simply expect them to happen, they're not going to happen. You actually have to put in effort.
When we talk a little bit about the complications of this and what it leads to, I mean, obviously, when you're isolated, it could easily lead to depression. I mean, that's the obvious one. But talk about data and what it has shown us in the long run, what other things has loneliness led to that are impacting our community?
Yeah, I think you highlight a really important connection. Loneliness, when advanced, really does connect pretty quickly to depression. And what happens, what we know about depression, which is, you know, feelings of sustained sadness, feelings of tearfulness, sleep disturbance, having no energy, or even being really irritable much of the time. When you have those kind of symptoms going on, it makes it really difficult, actually, to deal with other circumstances in your life. And if you happen to have a chronic health condition like diabetes or heart failure or orthopedic problems, your ability to manage your diet, take your medication as it's prescribed, exercise on a regular basis, all of that stuff goes downhill. And it becomes a really vicious cycle, which is the depression leads to not really being connected with your doctor, not doing the things that really make a difference in your health and your outcomes. And before you know it, all of these contribute to really unhealthy circumstances and unhealthy behaviors. And the unhealthy behaviors get into, you know, what are the things that, okay, what can I do? And people fall prey. We saw this especially during the pandemic. They fall prey to those short-term fixes like using drugs or using alcohol. And those become things that initially feel like, oh, that was a little bit of a relief. So it's helpful in the very, very short term and potentially ruins your life in the long term.
It's interesting. Because I almost feel like everything is getting back to the pandemic again. But when we, you know, in terms of the amount of harm that we see in the long run, the secondary effects of it. But I want to get back to what you can do about it. You already mentioned some of the efforts that you need to make to go out and meet people and talk to people. Some people just don't have that personality. I mean, what do we do for those folks?
Yeah, it's a great question. I do think this is, we can't just think of this as the individual trying to affect change. We really do. And the reason that the Surgeon General talked about this as a public health issue is frankly to activate many, many other things other than a given individual. There's a requirement that communities activate their social structure. You know, are we building the proper parks in the right neighborhoods that allow people to feel like this is a shared space where I'm going to go to? And even if I want to sit in a public space and read a book and be alone, I'm around other people that I hear people doing things. So So the proper kind of transportation, the proper connection to digital health and well-being, there's so many things that people that we need to think about, not just at the individual level, at the family level, at the community level, and really at a national level to create the right kind of policies that really support people engaging with people and really, you know, there is something about spending all of your time scrolling and thinking somehow that you're deep in relationships with people. But frankly, most of those are very superficial and they're not what really makes a difference when somebody is going through a hard time.
It's interesting because, you know, all the solutions you've mentioned and none of them have been related to starting medication or, you know, starting some type of therapy more than actually just really just taking an effort and maybe redesigning our communities.
But, yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I do think there are circumstances where, you know, loneliness triggers to a level of depression and anxiety disorder and underlying issues could actually benefit from therapy at times. But I think the bigger issue is I think sometimes people don't fully understand how they themselves are perpetuating some of the circumstances that they are in. And it really takes intention to begin to behave differently.
Let's get back a little bit to the demographics of it. Are we seeing this more in young people, older people? What age groups are we seeing it more in? And are we seeing it just more in this country as opposed to other countries?
You know, I'm most familiar in talking about it, of course, in this country. And I think, again, the Surgeon General is completely correct. This is an epidemic in this country. I'm most concerned about the population of young adults moving into early adulthood. That's a population that I see as particularly vulnerable and have fallen prey themselves for an overuse of social media in a way that really gets in the way of developing relationships. Older adults are generally insulated from some of this because they do rely on some of the more natural community supports, like faith communities, the YMCA. They have hobbies, they have interests. And I can't say strongly enough that a big part of this, Tony, is about having interests and passions. And they don't need to be things that, you know, are rich with tons of people like going to music concerts. They could just also be chess clubs or stamp collecting. But having a shared thing that people like to do together is a really important insulation for health and well-being.
You know, one of the things I think, and you already alluded to that, is we've built our communities that we rely so much on operating a motor vehicle. And obviously, when you become older and you lose that ability, that has to lead to more isolation as opposed to living in a neighborhood like in Manhattan or somewhere, some city where you can get out. Has that been a big issue for the older population?
It is. And that's one of the what I would say is I want to be clear to not paint all social media as a negative. I do think for older adults, the use of some social media can be really helpful because it does allow them. But I will tell you that there are very few people over the age of 60 years old that are using social media and say things like, I've got 567 friends. They use social media to genuinely connect with people that have been important in their lives, that are people that they have a deep, abiding relationships with. And that's a way that this can be helpful. But certainly public policy issues around transportation and people, again, there is something to be said for getting out of the house and even walking on a local sidewalk because you will bump into people. And at least it provides the opportunity to interact with people other than staying alone in your house or apartment.
Do we see it more in men or women, or is it pretty equal?
I think we probably hear more about it from women. I think actually the episodes of loneliness in men is actually very significant. They're generally not as inclined to have natural supports in place that they know how to activate, and yet they won't talk about it, which is very classic for men regarding all sorts of health conditions. And they're particularly at risk for things to really get to a point that become very problematic, very symptomatic, and then lead to coping strategies, as I mentioned before, that in the short term look like they're going to help, but actually turn into a much bigger problem, like substance use.
I want to switch a little bit over to the new facility. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Ridge Recovery Center that I think a lot of people don't know about. And yeah. I'd love to get your take on it and your explanation for everybody to make them aware of this new recovery center that's available for our citizens here in Connecticut.
Well, thank you, Tony. We're very proud of this. This is a really important residential facility that provides care and treatment for people with alcohol abuse and dependency, substance use conditions like abuse of opioids, prescription medicines, those kind of things. We've doubled our capacity for substance use residential treatment with the opening of the Ridge Recovery Center. It's located in the hills of eastern Connecticut. It's a very private location with private rooms, private bathrooms, a Planet Fitness gym. I'm incredibly proud that we have committed to doing this at Hartford Healthcare. I think it's a unique thing. It's on 55 acres up in eastern Connecticut. It's a very big, and frankly, people don't need to leave Connecticut to get what is often referred to as luxury rehab. It's a state-of-the-art treatment program, provides evidence-based treatment for people with substance use conditions. And the reason we did it, Tony, of every 10 people who have a treatable substance use condition, less than 3 get treatment.
Really?
Less than 3, yeah. So there are 7 people out there out of every 10 who have a treatable substance use condition that are not getting treatment for a very treatable health condition. And if you get treatment for it, people get better. So we were really committed to creating better access in a way that is also very affordable for people in the state of Connecticut and throughout New England. And we are providing evidence-based care to everybody in our community who needs it. We're very proud of what we're doing at the Ridge Recovery Center.
Let's talk about the access issue, because obviously, you know, care such as that is expensive. Is that a big obstacle for people? Why only 3 out of 10 are getting it?
It actually isn't. I think the larger issue is you have to leverage the moment of opportunity. I'll tell you, I have a feeling there are people listening to this radio show, because I know your audience and I know how big it is. There are people right now listening to us who are saying, you know what? I've got a bigger problem on this, and it's probably important that I dig into it. And yet, if you don't take advantage of that window of opportunity, it's quick to disappear. So I think it's important that we're really responsive and take advantage of the moment where somebody says, my life is not going the way I want it to, and perhaps substance use is part of that problem. And so let me go dig into that a little bit. But for example, the Ridge Recovery Center accepts all third-party insurances. We take people on Husky throughout our Rushford treatment programs in the state of Connecticut. In and of itself, financial barriers should not be an issue for people seeking care, not just for substance use conditions, but for primary care and for any other health condition that people are suffering from.
More that's really important to hear. Now, how does someone get referred? Is it through their primary care physician? Is it through the emergency department, through a psychiatrist? If someone is listening now and realizes they have a problem, what's the next step? If we're talking about that moment, and this is the moment, what is it they should be doing?
Yeah, thank you for that. Well, first off, the way we approach this, no wrong door. There's no wrong pathway to get into treatment. So everything that you just said, you know, as you know, we believe at Hartford Healthcare that your primary care doctor really is the quarterback of your care and treatment. So, yeah, getting in touch with your doctor, certainly emergency departments. But if you yourself are listening right now thinking, you know what, this is probably something I should educate myself a little bit about, first, just go to theridgerecovery.org. We have a beautiful website there that will really explain the kind of services that we provide, give people a sense of, you know, how this place operates and is it something that feels like a good fit for me. And then, of course, you can just call us. We're available 24/7. The phone number is 877-577-3233. And we've got people standing by. They'll pick up the phone. And it doesn't commit you to anything. It's just like, listen, I'm thinking this is something that might be a problem. Can you help me learn a little bit more about my, what my treatment options would be? And then we just begin the process. So I would encourage anybody, you know, explore the options, look at our website, and get a feel for, is this a place that is going to help me begin to make some changes in my life that could have really beneficial outcomes for the person, for their family, and frankly, for our communities, Tony.
Jim, thank you. Thank you for your time today. I know you have a busy day, and I thank you for taking time, and thanks for just making yourself always available to our listeners.
I'm always happy to do it. Thank you, Tony, very much.
Many thanks to our studio producer, Kevin Corza, has been on the board. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. I did want to make mention of something that came up this week. And just to use kind of springboard off of what Jim O'Day was saying. My daughter went to donate blood at a blood drive, and she met a volunteer there who was an older gentleman and is a listener, an avid listener of our program, and has taken what we've said here to heart, is that you should have a purpose. Here's a man who's out volunteering his time to get people to donate blood. And it's so important to our longevity and also important to what Dr. O'Day just told us, to get out in the community, have a purpose, and be around other people. So there are people doing this. I applaud all our listeners who are out there and listening to us and making changes in their lives, no matter how old they are. Once again, many thanks to Jim O'Day for coming on and sharing his time with us today. If you have questions for me, reach out to me at info@alessimd.com. If you missed any part of today's program, just go to the Healthy Rounds podcast. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. This has been Dr. Anthony Alessi. Until next week, please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rachford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.